You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey you, it's Dawn Sarah with this week's episode of Sex Gets Real. I've got Cooper Beckett joining me. It's been a couple of years since he was on the show, and we talk all about the swing set takeover at Desire and all of the adventures that happened there and how they inspired a new book full of sex. Cooper talks all about the changes in his life in the 7 years since he started doing life on the swing set and how he moved from a very traditional swinger to someone now who is really working not to label the relationships he's in and all of the amazing things that have happened. We also answer a wonderful listener question from a cis guy who has trouble achieving orgasm whenever he's having partnered sex. Cooper has personal experience with erectile issues and struggles to orgasm sometimes himself, and so he has some lovely, compassionate, and super practical advice. I think you're really going to love this. We get deep and we laugh, and Cooper has some amazing nuggets of wisdom, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Of course, if you're looking for ways to level up in your life, my biweekly Sex is a Social Skill group calls are going on, and we are having a blast. Every other week, we get together and practice all kinds of skills. We geek out on things like anger and love and what it means to be cherished in relationship. It's a really good time. It's $13 a month, but that gets you 2 calls a month with me that are 90 minutes. So check it out. Check out the show notes or head to sexgetsreal.com to learn about it. And of course, folks on Patreon who pledge at $20 or higher get free access to those calls. And if you want to support me at $1 or $3 or $5 a month, every single dollar helps so much, and I appreciate it. So go to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show, or head to sexgetsreal.com/EP172 to learn about those live biweekly calls I'm doing all about love, sex, and relationship skills. So Cooper Beckett is the co-founder and host of Life on the Swing Set, the podcast, since 2010, author of swinging and polyamory novels, A Life Less Monogamous, and Approaching the Swingularity, and the memoir My Life on the Swing Set, Adventures in Swinging and Polyamory. He teaches and speaks on swinging, polyamory, pegging, play parties, and coloring outside the boundaries of your sexuality. He is a graphic and web designer, photographer, and voiceover artist. He's been a guest expert on Dan Savage's Savage Lovecast and is the announcer of Tristan Taramino's radio show Sex Out Loud. He's currently working on 2 instructional nonfiction books, one about beginning non-monogamy and another about pegging. And of course, because he loves pegging, and Tristan, we both love her, that is where we start the show. So here we go, and enjoy.
Welcome back to Sex Gets Real, Cooper. I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm so excited to be back. Thank you for having me back.
You are so welcome.
It's been 2 years now, right?
Yeah, it's been a while. Actually, the last time you were here, I think I still had a co-host. So
wow. Yeah, I remember that. You did have a co-host.
Yeah, yes. Dylan. Yeah, she had amazing professional things happening for her that required her to step away from podcast life, since this was just a fun thing for her where it's more my job for me. And so
isn't that what we all hope for, though, is that an amazing thing will come along and take us away?
Yes,
from whatever we're doing.
Exactly. That just like the perfect storm will happen and the yeah. thing that we've always wanted will land in our laps. And that happened for her. So
well, that's
you
great.
Know, can't fault her for that at all.
No,
and, you know, not at all. We send her lots of love, but you've been up to all kinds of awesome stuff.
Oh, it's because I can't stop working. I just never stop.
You have books that you're writing and then audio versions of that with many, many, many actors. And got SS Desire and you've got several podcasts that you're on. So like, you're not joking when you say you work a lot and do a lot of interesting things.
And that all fits around day-to-day life, you know? Yeah. So it's like, it's too much really for any one person.
So let's hear about SS Desire. I know that Tristan Taramino is going to be there this year, which like, is a huge draw.
Oh yeah. We are so thrilled that she can join us for the first time. She's never been to Desire Resort in Cancun, and this is our sixth trip there and our second takeover. So we run the resort for a week in November. And I'm so excited to introduce her to our group there, because I've always felt like she and I are looking for the same communities. And that's what this trip really represents to me, is building my community once a year in a concentrated place, but then spreading that out over the rest of the year. It's a lot like what Burning Man is to everybody who's come back from Burning Man.
Yes.
It's that kind of space outside of reality. And she and I are going to teach an anal class together.
Oh my God, what a dream.
I know. And I'm like, I've been teaching a pegging class with my partner Ophelia every year, where, you know, the nice thing about going to a swinger resort is your classes don't have to be theoretical.
You're like, and here's me actually being pegged.
Indeed. So we talk about it. Ophelia and I have talked about it. And then I lie down and she pegs me. And then we talk about what's happening. And then I usually have a prostate orgasm and need to defer on the talking to her. But this year, Tristan's going to be there also with a strap on, and she's going to be demonstrating and talking about anal on women. So we're running the gamut.
Oh, that's so fun.
I know. I'm probably more excited about that than anything else.
Well, and I have to say, like, you know, I've taught a lot of different workshops about a lot of different things, but I think that what's really common for so many people is that even if you take a class, there's still kind of that like element of fear of like, this is new, this is an edge, this is a boundary. I don't know if it's for me. Everybody else in this room might love it, but I don't know if it's for me. But there's something really special when you then actually get to see people do it.
Yeah.
And the way that like folks like you and Tristan and Ophelia would negotiate and adjust and talk in the moment and make it fun. You know, I really think that kind of lowers the barrier to entry even more, because people are like, well, he looks like he's having fun. So maybe I can have fun too.
You know, and it's funny that you say that, because like 2 years ago, I was having some physical issues and I had to stop. Be midway through the pegging class. And, you know, a lot of anal play for men can bring up a lot of emotional baggage, and unexpected emotional baggage too. And so having to stop this class that I've taught so many times brought up a lot for me. And the group of people who were there were saying that it was actually better that they saw that than, you know, a completed class, because it showed unequivocally that sometimes it doesn't work and it's okay to stop, you know, which is something I don't think we learn with sex stuff. You're just sort of supposed to continue on.
Right.
Or force it.
Yep.
You know, like a lot of men who have erectile issues, they try to force it. And there is nothing less effective in treating erectile issues in the moment than trying to force an erection, because it's just not really possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's cool, because since it's real and it's, you know, demonstrated right there. And we invite people that if they want to do the pegging thing next to us in tandem, you know, they can. So if they want to watch and do it at the same time, they can. And that's just an experience you really can't get in the States, but in really in general,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, that makes me think of so many things. Like one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking was I really love pegging my husband. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that taught me was when he's receiving, he's very vocal about like, okay, slow down, speed up, hold still. That's a good spot. Oop, that's too much. We've got to stop now. And hearing him be vocal actually gave me permission to be way more vocal when he's fucking me. And, you know,
oh, yeah. I think
oftentimes we're kind of socialized to like, no, it'll get better. Just wait for it to get better. And instead it's like, well, no, if he can be bossy to me when I've got something on his ass, then I can be bossy to him when he's doing things to all my holes. But, but you know, I also, right. I had the chance to see a hand sex class with Amy Jo Goddard last year.
Nice.
And she had demos, and there was something really beautiful watching the people in the room who had never seen sex happen before. You know, like they had seen it in porn or maybe in their own lives, but to actually sit in a room with people at a conference who had never seen sex happen in front of them, there was just something really like just beautiful that kind of unfolded, and I could actually see it happening in people, kind of this like sigh or this yeah. like, oh, okay, that this is okay. Or even like, maybe it's not the worst thing to use my hands. And there's just so much permission, I think, in like, let's go to this desire week and watch people have sex and go to these awesome classes and, you know, get to see things you're not going to see anywhere else. And to just like, really get to like marinate in all of those experiences.
And without the theatricality that accompanies the sex we watch. Because, I mean, even you know, so-called amateur porn still looks more theatrical. Almost anyone participating in porn is doing it as a performance. And so I really, one of my favorite things about non-monogamy is that I have the opportunity to see what real sex looks like a lot more than I ever had before.
I was wondering, as I was reading your new book, Approaching the yes. Singularity, which is has lots of sex in it. For anybody,
I felt like I put too little in my last novel, A Life Less Monogamous. And so I felt like I'll just swing wildly in the other direction.
Yes. So anyone yeah. looking for a book full of all different kinds of sex, this is the book for you. But I'm wondering, like, it's very clear that so much of this book is based on SS Desire and your oh, yeah. takeover and the things that you've seen and personally witnessed and experienced. And I'm wondering, like, how much of it is really informed by the people that you know, the relationships you've had, the things you've been told that happened to people there? Because it feels very real.
Well, I've always felt like I'm pretty good at synthesizing, you know, like I'll take input from a lot of sources and can combine them and alter them and come out with something unique. And so the biggest thing that happened to me as I was writing this book is I found myself basically fragmenting my personality. There is huge chunks of me in all seven. There are seven lead characters in this book. And there is something major from my personality in every one of them. So like Krista, one of the two lesbians, has the conflicted sex drive that I have. Ryan has the anxiety that I have and the curiosity that I have. You know, it's so I could imbue these characters with these major things that I dislike about myself, I guess. And it's fun because it allows me to really explore from a position that I know and then take a lot of other things that I've heard or that I've seen or that I've experienced and blend that together. So the big thing that I tell people is that there is no one person in this book that is based on a person I know, but there are people that share similarities there are people that are, you know, there are characters who are based on seven people I know in this amalgamation where they may read it and not realize that it's partially them, which is important to me because I find it, I think it's lazy fiction to just write someone you know.
Yeah.
The most obvious correlation is between the character of Paige and Ginger, my co-host from the podcast. And Paige and Ginger are not the same person, but I find when I'm at a loss for what Paige might be saying, I think about what Ginger would say in that situation. So she's my keystone for this character. And a lot of the characters have a central keystone that when I'm stuck, I go here. But yeah, the events, the things that happen in the book, I've seen all this shit. It's, I mean, not necessarily in those configurations, but but similar. What I really wanted to get across too, and if you sign up for my mailing list, you can read the first four chapters for free. And the first four chapters include, three of the chapters are sex scenes, not just include sex scenes, are sex scenes.
Yes.
And what I wanted to nail down, and I found myself doing this unconsciously before I just reflected on these chapters, is the idea that as much as we want to be fully 100% present in the moment for sex, rarely are we. And it's not that we're not there. It's just that there's life and there's distraction and there's anxiety and there's these things that we think about ourselves and our partners. And I wanted to address the idea that while we're having this amazing sex, we're also, yes, disturbed by the fact that we lost our job, or so we can swing back and forth into the really hot stuff and then the distraction moment. And I feel like that's, you know, a lot of people have told me that the sex in this is sort of more real than they usually read. And I think that's what it is. Because we so often, when we're writing sex, we're writing sex as this transcendent moment.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is. But I know as a person who almost never gets out of my head, I never can quiet the voice.
Yeah.
And that voice amuses me. So, you know, not in the moment, but it amuses me in general because I feel like it's something that we don't talk about.
I totally agree. I actually really loved that in those first couple of chapters, this specifically kind of, I'm going to obsess about this person and why they're texting us or whatever it is. And, yeah. And no, I want to come back and be here with this person. And then the thought drifts in again and, oh, wow, that felt really good on my clit. And like, oh, I'm still thinking about the thing. Oh, I feel an orgasm coming. You know, and like the fact that we can kind of call ourselves back over and over and over again. And sometimes we don't need to do that. Sometimes it's just, I am so lost in what's happening. But I think you're so right of like the reality is that often we are thinking about how our body looks or a weird smell that we just smelled or that text that we got from our mom 15 minutes ago or whatever it is. You know, but like that doesn't mean that we can't still enjoy it. We just have to kind of work with how it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like when you put that type of thing in fiction, it helps lessen the anxiety of people who wonder if that makes them abnormal. You know, I really tried to do that a lot in this book, is address those things that we worry about. And when I say we, I mean it very clearly because I worry about everything. And, you know, one of the biggest revelatory moments for me in media was seeing High Fidelity for the first time. And High Fidelity is that John Cusack movie from, I think, late 90s, maybe early 2000s. What it was revelatory about it is that he is not a traditional romantic lead. He fucks up. He makes poor decisions. he's not always thinking of everybody else around him. And what is that if not everybody? That's our lives. And so my characters do bad things. They make bad decisions. And they fuck up because I need to see that in media because I always feel like a fuck up. And so I need to see other fuck ups because it makes me feel less of a fuck up.
Yeah.
And it was a focus of mine then.
And well, it feels like there was this one point in the book where I remember one of the characters is kind of being indecisive. And in that indecision, he's actually making a decision that is hurting his wife.
Yes.
And so she just kind of is like, well, I'm going to go off and do the thing that I wanted to do. And you can just sit here and either not do the thing or do the thing that's destructive or whatever. And he has to kind of contend with that.
Yeah.
And that speaks so much to so much of the distress and the pain that I see in emails that come in here from,
oh, sure,
from people, you know, who are struggling with those tough decisions or who have made mistakes and are trying to find ways to recover or whether or not to share the thing. And so I really appreciated that you had, you know, things like that in your book, because those are real. I mean, like, I think the amazing thing is it's like this super sexy, sex fucking filled book about basically what happens at SS Desire. And mm-hmm. it brings in the reality of what it means to be in relationship and navigating all these different conversations and feeling kind of anxious or terrible about yourself or not wanting to be naked in front of others. You know, I mean, like, that to me is like one giant permission slip that's also really super sexy.
Oh, excellent. Good. Yes. Yes. And I like fucking up the characters. I just like that. Like the so this is sort of a sequel. It follows the same characters as my first book and more, but I made it so it wouldn't be dependent on having read the first one. But in the first one, the main couple go through hell as they open up their relationship, and it nearly breaks them. And they've met this couple that they see as perfect, the veteran swingers. So when I started writing this one and started like breaking out my story, I realized that I wanted their storyline to be internal rather than external. You know, they're not going to be fighting each other. They're going to be fighting themselves. And then I immediately said, well, we're going to see exactly how not perfect this other couple is. And I'm going to nearly destroy their relationship. It's also, I mean, you know, why read fiction if there's not catharsis of some sort going on? So I feel like, yeah, it's big, but, you know, it's important.
So I'm wondering, for people who are curious about SS Desire and what it might be, yes, like, do you think reading this book is a really good way for them to kind of like be a little bit voyeuristic of like, what actually happens there? And does that sound fun for me? Would you say this is a pretty accurate representation of just kind of like the general flow and some of the things that you may see and things you may hear if you were to attend such an event?
I think so. Yes. I also will caution them that the intensity of the book is mostly, again, internal. It's mostly people dealing with their own demons. And so it may seem a little bit more intense than it might actually be. But at the same time, this is a, you know, if you think about the intensity of a swinger party, it's that you're going to a place probably because you want to fuck other people. So you're taking the intensity of a night out at the bar where you're trying to pick someone up. And you're taking the intensity of, okay, now I have performance anxiety or whatever. And then you're extending that to a lot of people also wanting to pick people up and being naked for much of the time. And then you're extending that again for 7 days. And it catches up to me every year. You know, you can ride hard. Ride life hard. And then about 2/3 of the way through the week, you realize, okay, I am mortal after all. I need to dial it back or I will just completely disintegrate. And so you have your down moment. And what I did is I spread these couples' down moments across the book. So that's why it's extra intense. But desire is unlike any place on earth. You know, it's so much at once. And it's so much amazing at once because it's one of the few times I really get to be in a legitimate community of people who love each other and treat each other unbelievably well. Obviously not everybody, because it's people. And at the same time, it's incredibly cathartic, because you work through things, because that's what we do when we're in intense life situations. We work through our own baggage. We work through our own demons. And every year there's something that comes up for me that I'm surprised by and happy that I worked through, but maybe not happy in the moment that I'm dealing with it. This past year was a certain thing that happened on a certain Tuesday in November.
Ah. Oh,
so
oh, yeah.
There was that I had to work through.
That's fucking terrible.
Yeah. There were a lot of people wandering around like, how do we still have fun?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of talked about how, like, every year for you, there's these amazing experiences and also these lessons that you're kind of processing. And I know you have been doing Life on the Swing Set, the podcast, since 2010. Mm-hmm. So you've been doing it now for over seven years.
Yeah.
And I mean, for you, like, what has that arc been like?
Oh, God.
What are the big things that for you have either changed or kind of the common threads that just keep coming up?
The most common thread is that I don't know what I'm doing. And I think that's important.
Yep.
But, you know, when I started, I was a fairly traditional swinger. And by traditional swinger, I mean I was part of a couple who would get together with other couples and swap partners. And sometimes have more of an orgy, but generally it was one to one, you know, and two to two. And I thought the way swingers thought, you know, I didn't much care about safer sex beyond condoms for penetration, because most people don't much care about safer sex beyond condoms for penetration. I thought about unicorns the way most people do, you know, that hey, we can bring this person into our lives to serve a function for us. And that's a horrible way to think about another human being.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like my first book, my memoir, My Life on the Swing Set, was cobbled together from 5 years of blog posts. And I cringe when I look at the beginning of that book at who I was then. And, you know, I wasn't a bad person, but I feel like I've evolved so dramatically since then. And a lot of it is that I try not to box myself. You know, I went from monogamy, which is a box, to swinging, which is a slightly bigger box. And that was so limiting, and I didn't know it. And so now I focus much more on every individual interaction and what this is going to be. Are we going to be lifelong friends? Are you going to be a flash in the pan interaction? Is it a one night stand? Is it a relationship? Is it fuck buddies? What is it? What do we have? And that was a tremendous gift of freedom to start looking at it that way. And because of that, because I found that freedom, I started looking at almost everything in life that way, that I will see what it looks like when it looks like something. I'm trying so hard not to determine in advance what things will be, because that's also a major source of stress for me. Mm-hmm. And that's my evolution. And the realization that I'm not done evolving is the most important thing that I've learned, because you know, I was married, long-term married before it. I had been married for 7 years before I opened up. And as grown-ups, we sort of think we've stopped evolving. And that may be true for some of us. But I think in general, it's we think we've stopped evolving because we see the limit of our existence. And that limit of our existence, the appearance of a limit, is actually what's limiting us. Mm. And so like all these projects I work on, I work on them because I can't not because I think this is going to be the thing that catapults me somewhere else. You know, it's because I'm going to try this for a while. And if this doesn't work, I'm going to try this for a while. You know, when I started the podcast 7 years ago, I wasn't thinking about a year later. And it's amazing to me that I started something open-ended. Most projects I do have endings. You know, eventually the book comes out. Mm-hmm. But the podcast is a completely different beast because it doesn't have an ending. It will end at some point. But theoretically, it could not.
Yeah.
You know? And that's a weird thing to wrap your mind around when you think about it.
It really is.
Because how do you know when you're done?
Yep.
You know, so what's great about the way I work projects is I hurl myself into things before I have time to realize how much work they'll be. I never would start a podcast the way I did. Because it's easier to do a one-on-one interview podcast, obviously, wrangling people and voiceover tracks. And so it's a good thing I didn't think about it.
I'm just going to do this thing.
Because it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And it is responsible for nearly everything in my life. Mm. And I think when we overthink at the beginning of anything, we run the risk of limiting ourselves from those beautiful accidents. Like literally my partner, Ophelia, I met because she heard the podcast. And I never would have met her if I hadn't done this crazy, stupid, time-sucking thing. Mm-hmm. So everything I do, every interaction with another person, every project I start, I try not to, you know, it's so different from the rest of my existence, which is worry about everything. I try not to think at all beyond the starting point, if I can help it. Mm. That was a very long answer, and I'm not even sure I was answering your question.
No, it was wonderful. I mean, I think one of the things that's just so beautiful about everything you just shared is, you know, so many of the questions and the stories that I get here, which are often very long and very vulnerable, is frequently tied to these very set expectations.
Oh,
around
yes.
What my body should be doing, how it should look, the type of relationship that I need to be in, how I feel about porn, how sex should happen in order for it to count as sex. You know, and it's kind of all of these like small little boxes that people feel so much pain and suffering around because it's not quite working and they're trying to find the way to make it work without having to change or to say the scary stuff. And hearing you and your story and how you kind of moved from being in these boxes and having these expectations to now trying to allow yourself to just know that like, it's never done. I'm just going to keep learning right. And evolving. I mean, that sounds like it's not that it's going to be suffering or pain free as we all know,
right.
But it kind of gives you this opportunity to like, well, here's where I am. So where can I go from here instead of I shouldn't be here? Let me try and change the things.
Yes. Yes. And there absolutely is pain and suffering from this approach. And you do protect yourself. It's like I liken it to the difference between monogamy and non-monogamy. You are sort of protecting yourself from falling in love with someone else in monogamy. It's not a complete protection. You still may do it. But since you're not actively looking around, you probably won't, right? So opening up to non-monogamy, it's just like, well, okay, now those training wheels are off, the limits are off, I could do this at any time, and yeah, it could blow up in your face, absolutely. But is it? It's an artificial appearance of protection when you don't take risks.
Yeah.
You know, I liken it to the realization for me, like I got divorced, and that changed the way I think about a lot of things. I think that's really one of the cornerstones of my non-monogamous experience, is because so many people who are monogamous, and I'm not picking on monogamy at all, mm-hmm. but so many people who are monogamous think that their partner just won't leave them, that somehow monogamy or marriage or fiance or relationship, boyfriend, girlfriend, somehow that's locking them in. They've locked in this commitment and it's going to be there. And the realization that anybody can leave at any time, literally anybody for any reason at any time can walk out on you, because it's true.
Yeah.
We don't think about that because it's terrifying. But it's also amazing, because if my partner could at any moment for any reason leave, that means she's choosing not to. And choosing to be there is an active thing rather than a passive thing. Being somewhere because you have to or you need it is passive and it's desperate. But doing something because you want it, that's amazing. And it was a complete mind shift for me that really anyone, and I keep harping on it because it's amazing to me that I never considered that. That anyone could leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something that I recommend to every relationship, is recognize the fragility of relationships, because fragility causes you to be to treat it with care, not to be, you know, like sterile environment and surrounded with bubble wrap, but to care, you know, emotionally care. And that's amazing.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is just so important, just when it comes to relationships, is like the more that we can really open ourselves up to the fact that there's no guarantee that at any point a myriad of things can go wrong, can we then use that as inspiration to like keep really showing up, to actually let ourselves be seen, to have those hard conversations, to ask those scary questions, and to not ever get to a point where we just think, well, we're both here and we're stuck, so I might as well just like tolerate it, but kind of ignore you and not treat you really good. And like, I don't really want to hear about your day, so I'm just going to like, yeah, you. And instead realize, like, if I keep doing that, there might be a morning when I wake up and the other person says, I'm really tired of this. And guess what? I am leaving.
Exactly. There are a lot of things that I don't do because I'm afraid. And it's something that I work on every day, and I'm getting better at it. You know, I'm taking risks and getting, but still anxiety and chronic depression and all these things hold me back. And the more we can beat that back, and this is one of those do as I say, not as I do things, the happier we'll be. You know, I have a really close friend who met a new awesome person and then went out of town and he died. And, you know, it's like, we obviously know that we're all going to die. It's going to happen. But we think that it's going to happen way off, and it is so far off it doesn't matter. And we need to think that, because otherwise we succumb to despair.
Right.
And there's this really fine, weird balance that I'm striving for. I haven't found it, where I can see the fragility of life and my death and use it as a as an engine of change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the secret to life. And if I can just nail that down,
yeah,
you know, because why do we make choices? Why do we do anything instead of just sitting at home and watching comfort television?
Yeah.
It's because we need to live. I use this mantra in my first novel. The couple was having relationship problems and they were feeling like they were just sort of coasting through life. And they had the mantra that today is the day we live, because just existing is not enough. And I spent a lot of my life just existing. And it was fine. You know what? There's honestly nothing wrong with just existing, because you can be happy. You can live a life. But then I saw beyond it, you know, going to Desire every year. It's the closest to pure transcendence I've ever experienced. I'm not a spiritual person by any means, but going to this place where I can truly connect with so many people in such a short, intense time span, it's led me to aspire to that more often. And that's beyond just existing. You know, so you can't just keep, wow, yeah, I guess I'm having an existential day.
We love witnessing you in that. Well, and it's like making me have my own, you know, like hearing you talk about.
I hope it's a good one. I hope I haven't just put you down the rabbit
hole. No, not at all. But it is giving me, it's giving me a chance to kind of have some reflection and find some words around a thing that I have anxiety and panic disorder and I have trauma. And so, you know, I do a lot of the constant worrying and self-talking stuff. And, you know, for me, where I try to balance all of the little demons in my head and frequently fail is the edge of, you know, like I love my husband very much and he is an amazing, phenomenal human being. And we've created a relationship that's beautiful. And so I want that to continue to be a source that feeds the both of us. The demon side, the little voices in my head tell me all the ways that I'm never going to live up to what he needs. And so he's going to leave like at any moment. And so I need to constantly be working on myself or it's going to end, right? On the other side, I have this kind of reverence for what we are co-creating. And so I want to show up and I want to try new things and practice new thoughts and maybe fail at them, because that's about like growing together. And it's a very fine line between that, doing it from the place of not enough and doing it from the place of this is for both of us. This is for me. This is for us trying new things and seeing where we end up. No guarantees, you know, and just kind of allowing myself to flop back and forth between the two. And hopefully I get better and better at that, that I kind of move in the more like abundant direction than in the more scarcity direction. But like both of them happen. And I'm just constantly practicing that tightrope walk and failing frequently, but still getting back up and trying again.
Well, I think the key to any of it is failure. You know, the best, you know, as a person who doesn't exercise, it's ironic I'm about to use an exercise. but you know, when you're making muscle, you're literally tearing the fibers of the muscle as you work out. You're literally damaging yourself. And then healing is what makes you stronger. And that's another terrifying revelation that I had, was that the pain is what gives us the better.
Yeah.
You know, I was just talking to someone, a friend of mine today, who they just moved from really light casual swinging into poly. Mm. And it just sort of came on really quickly for both members of a couple. And they're dealing with how overwhelming it is. and how, you know, like they've dealt with emotions like this before, but never at the same time and never towards other people and never having to see their partner, you know, so there's all this stuff. And I said, like, the highs are much higher in poly than in monogamy. And this is my opinion. The lows are much lower in poly than in monogamy. And, you know, you're vacillating wildly on this sine wave here. But what's amazing is when you can just dial it up a little bit, because as you improve yourself, which is what all of this is about, improving yourself, as you improve yourself, you pull the lows up, maybe to the level of monogamy, maybe to the level of your best days. And if you can pull your lows up higher, the highs are still, the peaks are really high, you know, and that's why, like, I wouldn't, when people ask me if I'd ever be monogamous again, you know, it's one of the few things I am not hesitant to give an absolute. I don't believe I could ever not be open. And it's because I've seen behind the curtain, and behind the curtain are these amazing, transcendent peaks and experiences. And yeah, it's really hard. And it doesn't get easier, you just get better. But only if you want it, only if you work on it. And so it's not about your relationship, it's not about your partner, it's about you. We always need to be focused on being a better person, always, in every aspect of our lives. Because when we are, it improves everything. It improves all our relationships, it improves work, it improves what we do. It probably will improve how we sleep eventually. But it's got to be about us, because you can't change anyone. That's another thing along those lines of anyone can leave. You actually cannot improve someone. They have to do it for themselves. And the only way you can make them want to, really, is by improving yourself. If you can have this aspirational challenge like you were just talking about. You know, you want to live up to this opinion that you have of what your husband deserves. Mm-hmm. And so that will encourage you to work on improving. I'm confident that that goalpost is not nearly as far away as you think it is.
Yeah.
But the best part about having a further goal is you work harder. You know, it sucks because you have to deal with that existential emotional dread, you know. But that's how we improve. And I am without a doubt a better person than I was a year ago, 5 years ago, you know, 8 years ago when I started non-monogamy. Without question, I'm a better person now. And honestly, if I can continue to do that, even just a little bit, I think that's what a life lived is, because it's not really about anyone else in the end. It's about experience. It's about me, you know, which sounds selfish now, and I'm not sure why it sounds so selfish.
No, I think it sounds beautiful, right? I mean, like, it kind of goes back to you talking about that passive versus active approach to life and relationship, where so many of us, just because of the cultural soup that we're swimming in, kind of approach relationships and sex from this very passive thing. Like, it should just happen. It should just be there. It should just work out. But when we approach sex in a very active way, and we encourage our partners to be active in showing up, amazing things happen. That's where we have the opportunity to have transcendent sex, because we're both actively showing up, and the same for relationships. You know, I mean, even if you're asexual and aromantic and you don't want any kind of partner, you still have relationships in your life. And
yes, it is impossible to live a life without relationships.
Right. And so, like, if I'm actively working on being a better communicator, if I'm actively working at setting better boundaries, at listening to myself, at being more curious about others, and in really being able to open myself up to the ever-changingness of another human being, like, everything around me is going to improve. But that's really coming from me trying and practicing these skills and falling down. And then you're right. It kind of creates this, like, community effect if everyone starts leveling up together. And I think that's where we start getting like really powerful change happening, is when we all level up together, but it kind of has to start with us doing that work. And I think so many people are trying to find ways to not do that work because it's scary and uncomfortable.
And it's easy not to.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And I will, I'm just going to point out, I'm going to avoid the political aspects of what you just said. I'm just going to avoid it because it's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, this is all, you know, usually I'm more fun. I've had a very rough week. So I'm very much in existential, philosophical mode. And at the same time, there's this incredibly silly and fun thing that accompanies sex, especially when you move into sex with many people. Because, you know, a lot of us have a lot of reverence for sex. We sort of build it up to be so much more important than it actually is.
Yes.
And it's really worse when we're having very little of it, especially if we're in a relationship where we want more sex and it's just not happening and our partner does or doesn't, you know, the imbalance, which is literally the most common relationship problem,
yes,
is an imbalanced sex drive. And you know what? Almost everybody's is imbalanced. That's just true. So we build it up to be, well, if only we could have sex,
all these other things will be fine.
Yeah. And that's incredibly unfair to sex, because it's not all that. And this may just be the swinger talking, but sex can just be a wonderful way to spend a half hour. And it can be silly and it can be distracted and it can be funny and it can be a hand job or a blow job or eating someone out and nothing else. And that's, you know, you mentioned that sex needs to be a certain thing. It doesn't. And when we make it so much more important and put it on this pedestal, and it has to be us in dimmed light with music, and it will last for an hour, and we will have penetrative sex, and we will both orgasm. You know, it's unrealistic expectations.
Yeah.
And when you can just have fun with it, it's wonderful. I think there's a pureness to sexuality in non-monogamy, and pureness, I'll acknowledge, is a weird word to use for it, in that it is what it is. It's literally about the sex in those moments. And that teaches us to look at it differently. Because if it's only about the sex, you know, about fucking, and that's also a wonderfully beneficial thing, is if you can call it fucking sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, it can lead to demystifying it. Yeah, it's I keep cutting you off.
Oh no,
you
go it's okay. Ahead. I will, and I just want to build on what you just said of, like, you know, I've talked at length on this show about how, you know, because of toxic masculinity and sexism and misogyny and patriarchy, you know, that often men in particular are only able to find ways to get so many of their needs met through sex. And so sex becomes kind of a coded way of saying, I need affection, or I need to feel seen, I need to feel valued. And I think one of the beautiful things about what you're saying is, like, when we can take sex down off the pedestal and just acknowledge that, like, sometimes it's just this physical thing that maybe I got a little sweaty and my heart rate went up, or maybe I just, you know, got to share this moment with these other people, it kind of starts to highlight, wow, I have all these other places where I'm still not feeling seen or heard. So maybe it's not the sex. Maybe it's, I don't know actually how to ask for affection, or maybe I don't know how to express my feelings. And that's that kind of, it really shows you all the things you've been hiding behind under the guise of it's sex.
Yeah. Deep.
Deep. Oh my gosh. We're so smart. everyone gets to hear how smart we are. Let's just put that out there. Well, I'm wondering, would you have time to help me field one question from a guy about orgasm issues?
I promise not to take it to an existential place.
We shall see. Okay, so David wrote in, the subject line says, cis guy who struggles to orgasm. And his email says, hi, I'm a 26-year-old cis guy in a monogamous relationship with a 23-year-old cis woman.
Okay.
We're both queer, and she has exclusively dated women until me, so we navigate intimacy, sex, and pleasure very creatively and openly. I discovered your podcast series while looking for a podcast that discusses orgasms and people who struggle to achieve them. And not surprisingly, your podcasts have discussed the difficulty almost exclusively within the confines of people with vulvas. Mm. I have struggled with achieving orgasm in sex with a partner my entire life. While I can easily reach orgasm through masturbation, orgasming with a partner is difficult and often impossible. My current partner is the least judging or pressure-inducing partner in this regard that I've been with, and yet I've only achieved orgasm and sex once in the past couple of months of dating. Understanding how trying this is for me, we have alternative ways of helping me, including various incarnations of prostate stimulation and topping me through DS play. So I was wondering what advice and other sexperts might have for men who struggle with achieving orgasms in sex with partners, and how people in general who struggle with orgasming navigate relaxing, focusing, and letting go. Three conflicting concepts often promoted to achieve orgasm. Thank you. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. I've got a lot of thoughts.
Go.
Okay. First off, to give context, I have struggled a lot with performance issues especially over the course of non-monogamy, because it's an intense thing. And so I went through a long period where I had erectile issues. I definitely have orgasm issues occasionally here and there. And I'm going to say a number of things that are going to sound obvious and sound like you make it sound easy, but it's not. I know it's not. Okay. So first is achieve orgasm is a phrase I want you to stop using. Because it's not an achievement. It's a thing. It's a physical thing that happens. That's it. All right. It's no different, ultimately, than getting an erection, getting penetrated. It's just a thing that happens in sex. Okay. So, you know, when we talked about not defining sex as only penetrative and how important that was, not defining orgasm as the goal of a sexual encounter is also tremendously important. I know we want it because we want orgasms because orgasms feel good. Yeah, absolutely. But it's not the goal of the encounter. There's so much that goes on in the middle, especially if you're doing prostate play or it sounds like you have a wonderfully open and communicative relationship, which is fantastic. But even so, you are putting pressure on yourself to orgasm, which is putting pressure on her to help you orgasm. And so everybody's goal is this elusive thing. And the whole relax and it'll get better is true because that's actually how it gets better. but being told to relax is, again, like, say, you know, just don't think about the fact that you can't get hard.
Right.
When it is literally the only thing that you are thinking about at the moment. So how do we do that? Well, there's a few things here. One thing I would advise for the foreseeable future is go into any sexual encounter not planning to orgasm. Because if you're not, and not in a, oh, well, I won't orgasm, so who cares? Try to reframe it completely so that's just not part of the goal. Because if it's not part of the goal, it gets easier because you're not thinking about it. It's like when people are having erectile issues. When I was having erectile issues, I'll make it about me. What I would do is then go down on the person. Because it's nearly impossible to be thinking about your erectile issues when you're licking pussy. Nearly. Well, I mean, you can still think about it. As I demonstrated in my book, you still think about every failing you have. And when I say you, I mean me. So if you can distract yourself from the goal as much as possible, and no, it's not realistic to say all the time, but as much as possible, then that's ideal. Next, and I'm going to say this like a douchebag, why is masturbating yourself to orgasm during sex not achieving orgasm during sex?
Yes.
Because, I mean, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot, it is what every bit of advice for women who have difficulty achieving orgasm with a partner is told to do. Well, you know, use your fingers, use a vibrator, get yourself there. If you have an orgasm in the middle of a sexual encounter, it doesn't matter who actually created it. It's part of the encounter. So if you are able to masturbate yourself to orgasm, then just start doing it, you know, or get yourself really close. You know, if you're fluid bonded, especially, get yourself really close and then start fucking and then have your orgasm internally, because I know that's an important thing for a lot of people. And I get it completely. And the last thing, and the thing that makes it very difficult for me to come from a blowjob, from a hand job, really only from intense friction sex, is, I believe Dan Savage coined it, masturbation death grip syndrome.
Yes!
All right?
Yes.
Probably the problem here. And as a man who masturbates differently than most men, I'll just let you all use your imagination. It's really difficult to get people to use their hand the way I use my hand. And they shouldn't have to, honestly. They should be able to just stroke and it would be fine. So if it's really a concern, so everything I've said up till now is about making it less of a concern, right? Because it ultimately... That's a good goal to shoot for, is to not be worried about it. If you really want this, if it's very important to you, that's fine. Look at the way you're masturbating and try it differently. Try it differently every time. Use more lube so it's slicker. Use a looser grip, because most people who have problems like this, it's that you are squeezing yourself too damn hard and you're making it, because, you know, vaginas don't squeeze you like that unless the women are very good at Kegels, in which case sometimes they do. Mm-hmm. So you will never be able to replicate your experience with your hand with a vagina. And that's okay, because they're different. But if you really want that to happen, I actually did the... I did what's the name of the Fleshlight?
Oh yeah.
Fleshlight has a trainer kit that's about removing the masturbation death grip syndrome from you. So you the idea is you buy a looser Fleshlight and you only allow yourself to come with that. You obviously don't have to buy a Fleshlight to do that. The key is you can't just revert to what you were doing. You know, like sometimes I'll try something different and when it's not working, I'll just go back to the way that works. All that's doing is reinforcing to your body that this is how we come.
Yes.
And that is the thing, your body, you know, it's a completely different thing. We've talked about the mental portion, but the physical portion is all about neural pathways. And you can't just fix that by thinking about it. They actually have to be rewritten. And the way to rewrite them is to deprive yourself from orgasms unless you, you know, if you don't masturbate for a while and you keep having all the sex you're having with your partner, eventually you're going to come. Because your body is going to build it up. And you know how exciting that'll be the first time you come from just that? And then your body will be like, oh, yeah, right. That's how we do it. That's a reward. So all of this is a fancy way of saying, yeah, you got to relax a little. You got to want it a little less. Because that's how you make it happen, by wanting it a little less. And that it is the most frustrating way to look at it. But it is the only thing that helped with my erectile issues. It is the only thing that has helped with my overall feelings about sexuality, in fact, is when it was goal-driven, it was not as good. And it included failures, because it's easy to be a failure if you're not meeting a goal. But if you don't have a goal, what are you failing at? If you don't have an end game goal and you're having sex, you're having sex. So you've already succeeded at having sex. You didn't come. That's a different thing, you know? And if it's, yeah, if you can't leave that part alone, it's the masturbation death grip syndrome, I'm betting. But they both sound so sex positive.
They really do.
I want them to see behind the, you know, it's the lifting of the veil. I want them to see behind the stage and realize that the orgasm is not as important as we think it is.
Yeah, that was kind of what was coming up for me. Like, I so want to just like co-sign everything you said. I love the approach of like, let's not orgasm. That's literally what we're not going to do, where we're just going to like do all the things and let it feel really good and try all the ways. And at no point are we going to worry about me having an orgasm. Like that's the kind of sex we're going to have, is orgasm free sex for me. And then see what happens. Like, I think you're so right that so much of this also comes down to when we remove the goal, it opens up the creativity. I was thinking like both of Barbara Corellis's books, Ecstasy is Necessary and Urban Tantra, might be really interesting, because Barbara talks at length about, you know, thinking off and having like mental orgasms and finding ecstatic release that have nothing to do with your genitals. And that's applicable for people who are able-bodied and cis. And it's also amazingly applicable to people with disabilities or trans folks. So like, if it works for them, it can work for you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just kind of approaching it that way. And I'm also wondering, like, what does the orgasm mean? You know, like, why is it important? Because I think that's something that we don't ask ourselves. We just assume it's because everyone wants to orgasm. But like, why for you, David, is the orgasm important? Is it because you get a physical release? Because there's lots of other ways that we can make physical release happen. I mean, I experience amazing physical release and just like the most shudderingly like body melting sensations after like a really good flogging session. Or is it because it feels really good? Well, there's lots of ways for it to feel really good. And it's not like it's about having the wrong answer, but maybe giving yourself an opportunity to kind of really understand, like, is this about feeling broken? Because if it's about feeling broken, then that's going to actually make your body feel betrayed and shut down.
Yeah.
And so like asking all of these questions. And I'm also curious, like, why not try a magic wand?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know? Think outside the box.
Yeah. Use a vibrator. See what happens. I mean, maybe if your partner holds a vibrator, you know, against the base of your cock while you're stroking yourself, you'll have an orgasm while your partner's present. And I also just like, because of the email that David wrote, there's a part of me that just really feels hopeful that if the answer is, I just can't orgasm with other people in the room, so can we just get like super sexy and like, I'll get you off and we'll feel super good. And then when I'm ready to come, can you just like go step outside and have a glass of wine and I'll make myself come. And then like, I don't know, I just have this feeling of like being able to walk back in the room after he's come and just like celebrate his like fucking cum all over his chest and like kissing each other post orgasm or whatever, you know, like that doesn't make it less sex. It's just a different way of having sex.
sometimes we have to change the game.
Yeah. Thank you for helping me answer that. I love that you shared so pleasure. Much of yourself with that.
My pleasure. I know that's important for men specifically because they're, you know, I at no point want to make it sound like men have it tough because we don't. And all the things you said earlier, toxic masculinity, it's all things. But sensitive men sort of do have it tough because there's so much expectation of who we actually are and what we should want. And that's really worth exploring for him, is exploring what you think is expected of you. Because I imagine this wonderful sounding partner doesn't expect anything of you. And I imagine she's not saying, oh, don't you love me? Am I not attractive when you don't come? And that happens to a lot of men. It's happened to me. And that is the kind of pressure that we can't move through to get it to work, you know? So, yeah, it can be difficult, and it's so important to hear other people. It's like hearing other people fail. It's important to hear that other people have the same issues and are affected emotionally as well.
Well, I would love it if you would share with everyone how they can find you, stay in touch, get your book, hear your shows. Like, for folks who are like, oh my God, Cooper's so amazing, which I totally also co-sign because you are. How do they find you?
You can find pretty much everything at coopersbeckett.com. That is my home base. All three of my books, My Life on the Swing Set, which is the memoir, A Life Less Monogamous and Approaching the Swingularity, are the novels, are all available on my site as well as on every other book sale platform. But if you buy them from my site, I get more money, and I appreciate that because I am an independent. I am working on the crazy ambitious audiobook right now with 7 narrators. Woo! Because there are 7 main characters, and that just went on pre-order and will be available on September 5th. And if you pre-order it, you get bonus chapters and other things like being able to hear it early and getting outtakes and all the fun, silly extras that most audiobooks don't come with. My podcast is Life on the Swing Set, and you can find that at lifeontheswingset.com, as well as our entire Swing Set FM network, which is all sorts of sexy podcasts, as well as my silly TV-related podcasts about Twin Peaks and Hannibal. these are the many things that I do. I'm cutting back on some of them. and social media. I'm Cooper S. Beckett everywhere. And all those times where you felt me hold back about politics, if you follow me on Twitter, you will get all the things that I was saying in my head instead of saying them on the podcast. I also say them on my podcast, but I don't like to walk into other people's houses and just go off on politics.
They are used to me doing it. So I'm sure they will check out your Twitter and find we have some similar views.
I imagine so.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Cooper. This was amazing and fun.
Oh,
and
I will my have pleasure.
All of your links at Sex Gets Real. And like, thank you for just lending your voice and your spirit to this. This was great.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So to everybody listening, be sure to go to sexgetsreal.com for this episode. You can check out all of Cooper's links, check out his books, pre-order that audiobook. If you have any comments or questions about this show or anything going on in your life, you know I love hearing from you. And there's a contact form there with an anonymous option. And until next time, this is Dawn Sarah. Talk to you soon. Bye.